Well, hi there. I'm Jonathan Doyle, and I'm really excited that you've had a chance to access these live recordings from a seminar I gave recently on parenting. There's a focus here on young men. There's a focus on the role of fathers, but really the content here could be applied to what's happening for your daughters or for anybody who's got an interest in parenting, what's happening for young people. You're going to find some great stuff here. In the first session, I'm going to look at some big picture issues about the very core nature of parenting, what we're most desperately trying to achieve. Then I'm going to look at some of the big issues happening for young people so we understand their world a little better. And then in the second session, we're going to look more closely about what happens for us as parents. So I hope you can share these with people. I hope you get a lot out of them. Feel free to get in touch with me through the website. But for now, sit back, relax, and enjoy this first session on the crucial aspects of parenting and what's happening for young people. So the roadmap of what we'll do is I just want to spin through some opening concepts with you just around what's happening for boys, parenting in general. We'll look at some key issues that the boys are facing so that you're upskilled and get a good snapshot of what's happening for boys in general, what their world looks like, what it feels like, what it sounds like. Then this is new this year, is what I call learning our curriculum. What I am learning at the moment is that a seismic amount of effective parenting has to do with literally with me. What I'm bringing to the game, what I'm bringing generationally, what emotions and behaviours were sanctioned in my family of origin, what I bring to the table. So we'll probably have a coffee break halfway through. You know, if a couple of you don't make it back for that section, I understand. But because it's really hard, it's very hard to look at ourselves and go, what am I bringing here? What did I learn as I grew up? What am I channeling? Because I would say this very carefully, I think at least at this stage of my learning, in some ways it's often easier for us to change. For us to look at if there's conflict and dysfunction happening, it's often sometimes easier for us to be more reflective and to change than it is for them. I'm not sanctioning poor behaviour on behalf of your sons at any point, but sometimes that, if we can shift, we'll shift them pretty quickly. And then finally, just some very practical tips and ideas. I don't tend to take questions off the floor for a couple of reasons. Occasionally they're a little left field. I'm not saying they would be, but sometimes they can be. I will chase rabbit trails and go off on a mad tangent if you ask me a question for about 40 minutes. But what I will do is stay here till midnight. So if you want to see me at the end or in a break with any specific question, I'm happy to talk for as long as you'd like. So friends, some important opening distinctions. It's just to name two important initial distinctions. One is the ages of your sons. We're going to talk about mostly about sons tonight. There's obviously a big difference between parenting a son who's 5 and parenting a son who's 15 or 18 or 20. So as I range around boys' issues tonight, sometimes I'll be right in your sweet spot relating to younger children. Sometimes I'll come up a little bit higher to older boys. So just work with me depending on how old your kids are. I've got a 5-year-old son at the moment. The other important opening distinction is for single parents, lone parents. Firstly, you know, thank you for the very tough job you often do. I handle this very sensitively because sometimes I can just, people can be offended no matter what I tend to say. I'll be incredibly careful. I recognise the challenges and the difficulties having done this for a long time. If you're parenting on your own, you'll hear me a lot in this early section talk about the role of men and fathers. So sometimes if you're parenting as a mother alone, you can hear that as it's the end of the world, he doesn't have that. But listen carefully because I'll give you some strategies around that too. And don't hear it as you're doing anything wrong. Just hear it as the sociological fact that boys need men. As they need women too, but they really need men. So just acknowledging those distinctions. Feel free to take any notes if you've got an iPad or anything. I'll assume no one's updating Facebook, so take as many notes as you'd like to. We'll get you the video as well. But here are your core opening concepts. Number one is to just begin by reminding ourselves of the fundamental task of parenthood. In the midst of the daily battles in the trenches, we can very quickly forget exactly what it is we are fundamentally called or invited to do as parents. So we can fall into the trap of aspirationalism on one hand, like the most important thing is to get our kids into the best university place so that they can continue a trajectory of success because we love them, we care about them, and we culturally want that to happen for many of our boys. The other one is the other sort of pole is worrying about making sure nothing bad happens to them. So we can forget that there are other more fundamental things. I want to give that to you. Going back as far as Aristotle and from my postgrad background and from all the work I've been doing for the last 10 to 15 years, the fundamental task of parenting is character formation. Just hear it again. The fundamental task of parenting is character formation. Here's a thought experiment. If you had the option of your son being very wealthy for the rest of his life or being profoundly loving or profoundly good, noble, and you had to choose one or the other, it's a thought experiment, most of you would gravitate to the value system rather than the pure outcome. The fundamental task of parenting is character formation. So wherever you're at in your spiritual journey, it's basically as if God says to you, here is this child I'm giving you. I would like you to help form their character. What is character? Character is nothing other than the sum total of our choices. We become our choices. Our character is our choices over time. So the task of raising great sons is to raise young men of character, and we are culturally relatively short of them because the work of character is very difficult and it's very hard and it's not really culturally rewarded at the moment. So then what I want to do is position you to realize that all those little daily battles, all those things that are exhausting, all those things that you wish didn't have to happen are part of the task you've been given of forming a man of character. And it can be thankless. So from now on, you're in the business of character formation. If you don't remember a lot of what else happens this evening, remember that it's character formation. Because primarily what you're doing is preparing somebody who is going to go on to love and to be in relationship with other human beings. And you're paying forward a gift. If you can raise a great son, he'll be a young man who's capable of loving. So my task as a father is to raise a man of character who can love. That's fundamentally what I genuinely believe. If at the end of my journey with him, he can love, he can will the good of others and care for other people and be an authentic, integrated human being, you win. You can't control everything, but you can control quite a lot. Your son will become what he consistently chooses. Now, just on this, I really want to encourage you to realize you have much more influence and power than you think you do. It's a guy called Peter Thiel who just wrote a book called Zero to One. He co-founded PayPal. It's a very good book on entrepreneurship and business. And there's a section in it where he says, you can either see the future as hazily uncertain or you can see it as definite. And whichever one you choose, you'll tend to get the outcome. Life isn't quite as straightforward as that, but it means this. If you have a vision of your son really turning out as a person of character, and you see that and you're working towards that. It's what we call being deliberate parenting, especially for dads, deliberate fatherhood, being deliberate, engaged, switched on. This is what I'm doing. This is why it matters. Yes, I'm tired, but I'm going to commit. I'm going to engage this weekend. I'm going to be deliberate about this. Then you're seeing the future as kind of certain. Now, I know we can't control everything. Peer group, media influences, all sorts of things. But I encourage you to have a more definite snapshot of what you'd like it to look like at the end and what you're trying to get to. So this is Aiden a couple of weeks ago, and I had two quite profound experiences with him in the last week. About five nights ago, we'd been skiing and we got home late, and it was a great fun night. And as he goes to get into bed, he's only five, he goes, Dad, I've got to tell you something. I said, what? And he goes, I broke the model plane. We built a lot of little models together, and he'd stepped on one. He'd pulled back the Duna cover, stepped into bed and broken it. And he looks at me and he goes, I didn't want you to find out without me telling you. I'm really sorry. And I was just absolutely floored. I just said, look at what's just happened here. At five, he's taken some responsibility, accountability. There's some honesty in there. And I'm no perfect father, but I just went, holy crap, some of this stuff is working. You ever had that happen where you go, they actually listened, like something worked? But I realised that even then I'm beginning to initially form character. So I teach Aiden things like, Aiden, men always finish what they start, because Aiden has a natural capacity, like all your kids are different, right? They'll have different flaws. He'll have a capacity not to finish things. So the other day he's trying to finish colouring in and Karen goes, come on, you've got to go brush your teeth. No, Mum, men always have to finish what they start. And the other one was, I was really teaching about being patient with Stephanie, who's much younger. And when, on the way back from skiing, she was going nuts in the car and carrying on. And you could see him really trying to be patient. So it's those little journeys of character formation that matter so much. Last bits of the heavy stuff. We talk a lot about values, education, and forming values. We very rarely talk to you about what we call virtues. Values education is incredibly new, and it depends on who gets to define the values. And sociologically, whoever defines the values is whoever has the most power in a culture. Virtues are a much more ancient thing. They go back to Aristotle, through Aristotle to Thomas Aquinas. There are four cardinal virtues. Cardinal comes from the Latin, which means hinge. Hinge virtues around which everything else rotates. Why am I telling you this? Because virtues are habits. And some of the people I most respect in the parenting field are really getting big on virtues education. The definition of a virtue is an habitual disposition to do the good. An habitual disposition, a constant desire as much as possible to do what is right. There are four important ones. Prudence, which is what we call practical reason, which is the ability to look at a circumstance and go, what is the right thing to do here? How is that relevant to you? It's very relevant at 1:45 in the morning when your son is going to get a lift with somebody and he knows they've been drinking, or they know they're driving a V8, and he can look at it and he can use prudence. But he will only be able to use prudence if you've been teaching it to him in all the daily interactions for a long period of time. Prudence. Justice. To give to another person what is due to them because of what they are. We talk so much about, you know, getting boys to respect women, but I hear no one talk of justice. How do we teach young men to give justice to young women, to give to them what is due to them because of what they are? Well, then you have to teach them how to live justly from a young age. Prudence, justice, temperance. Temperance is the ability to moderate our appetites. So teaching boys and men from a young age to be able to moderate their strongest desires. Why? Because if a boy or a man eventually isn't in control of his strongest desires, it's a very simple equation. His strongest desires will eventually be in control of him. It is immutable. It's a law of how the universe functions. Sooner or later, when men blow things up and they blow up their lives, they'll blow it up around the area of temperance and moderating their strongest drives. But if men can learn to challenge them and direct them into what the experts call pro-social ends, awesome stuff happens. Prudence, justice, temperance, fortitude is courage. For your boy to become an extraordinary man at this moment, history requires that he has a lot of courage to go against often what peer norms might be. How does he have courage? Because you're constantly drilling it in and teaching it to him from a young age. That's relatively heady. But when I talk to principals and stuff, everybody's looking for the next thing on Sunrise or the next book by Ken Robinson or people like, you know, other speakers who are great, and they're good and it's all valuable. But this is the cardinal virtue stuff is the heavy lifting of real parenting, building virtue and character into a child from a young age. As we'll see in the last section, it's going to require that we cannot teach what we have not lived. We cannot teach what we cannot live. And we'll do this again at the end, but parenting is also about how God, the universe, however you conceive it, is shaping you. The great Polish philosopher Karol Wojtyła said, "My father never had to be hard on me because he was so hard on himself." Now, that could be construed as psychologically unwell, but you get the point. He was saying, my father didn't have to threaten me because he lived in such a way, with such grace and control, and that I saw it modeled, and I loved my father, and I wanted to please him, and I saw how to live through him. So let's talk a little bit about what's happening for the boys. And maybe at the end of the session, we'll have a short break, grab some coffee, flee the building, talk to other people, and then we'll finish with some simple practical stuff. So, you all okay so far? Okay. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what the young men themselves are facing. So my background was to teach in all-boys education. So I did a teaching degree, all-boys education, worked in boarding schools, coached elite-level sports with boys, just loved working with boys. And I still today just had a blast talking to your boys if any of them were in the senior school. And then a lot of post-grad work after that. Really simple snapshot. Males statistically outrepresented in violent crime, sexual crime. suicide, domestic violence, obviously drink driving, car fatalities, depression, different cohorts, and risk-taking behaviour. Just something very simple to understand. Prefrontal cortex, you've probably come across this somewhere else. Prefrontal cortex, just behind the plate of bone on your forehead, is the last thing that developed in the human person biophysiologically, anthropologically. It's the last thing that nature built. It's the higher order thinking centre of our brain where we do advanced abstract thinking. Fully formed in females around about mid to late teens. Fully formed in males, mid-20s. Karen used to say mid-30s. The first challenge, adolescent boys and particularly younger boys, and if you've got younger boys and you see them blow up, when they blow up, they just lose it. Either they're tired, they're hungry, and they just blow it completely. That's the prefrontal cortex overload. It's like they just can't process and cope fast enough, so it's boom. So you take your adolescent boy whose prefrontal cortex hasn't fully developed, so his ability for prudence and reason isn't fully deployed, and you add alcohol to that, inability to see consequences, risk-taking behaviour, which is part of the neural structure of adolescence. I see boys as quite vulnerable. And you know what else I learned about boys again today? Just how sensitive they are. They are trained to be so, they're just Teflon. I can tell you today, honestly, in the conversations that I had between easy 7 to 10 boys in tears, not sobbing, but just expressing things to me because I'm leaving. It's very easy for them to talk to me because I leave. But deep emotion welling up. Terribly sensitive. So I see them as kind of beautifully vulnerable at this point in their life, and they need mums and dads to really walk alongside them, really partner with them. The next big sociological phenomenon we're seeing, this is from a US sociologist, Kay Himowitz, who wrote a seminal book called Manning Up. That title's quite provocative there at the bottom, but it's a very, very interesting book. The term would be displacement, that, you know, for centuries and decades, men really understood their roles in culture and they just knew exactly where they fitted. Huge changes in our cultures have very much displaced men. Hear that very carefully, because women hear that not as a criticism at all, but as a sociological event. So boys are quite displaced. They're not quite sure where they fit, how they're supposed to be, exactly how they're supposed to conduct themselves at times. It's leading also that Himowitz and others will argue to a classic, what we call a Peter Pan syndrome at the moment, which is boys are delaying their entry into manhood longer and longer. They're avoiding the kinds of commitments that once defined men. So marriage and family is the classic one. Boys are now delaying it and delaying it and delaying it further and further. Examples, you get Hamish and Andy, who I showed this to the boys today. Now, these guys are really funny. And I said that's the boys because this isn't like a fundamentalist rant going, these are the anti-Christ of culture who are destroying young people. They're actually very funny, very gifted. And in terms of some of the really offensive stuff that's in media, they're quite harmless and very funny. But they're 40-year-old men literally behaving like 13, 14-year-old boys. And I sat in the business lounge in Sydney Airport about 2 years ago working on that slide. I do not make this up because I was going to speak at King's that day. And I turned there and next to me, true story, was this guy. And I just, and he had a cap on, and I just turned around and I just went, just like that. But it's the Peter Pan syndrome that through what I call booze, porn and PlayStation is allowing them to delay the kinds of deep commitments. So one of the points I taught the boys today is that a simple principle that in the end it's only your commitments that will truly define you. So what many of us here men know is that the things that we fundamentally committed to as men, marriage, relationship, pair of fatherhood, have actually defined us, that we become our commitments eventually. And boys are being kind of positioned to delay those commitments. We add, of course, the huge impact of technology on their neural structures, on especially, I'm not doing much on this tonight, but their formation, their sexual formation. So the fundamental modality or the fundamental way that boys are receiving their sexual formation is through internet-based pornography. So I spent years working in that area on sort of the neural impact of pornography addiction. So boys' capacity for romance, for beauty, for engaging with the feminine as equal is being profoundly corrupted by a very toxic and destructive depiction of human intimacy and sexuality. And quite frankly, unless men particularly are prepared to step into that space and provide sexual discipleship and mentoring and walk with their sons, then exactly who the hell do we think is going to do it? It's not easy work, especially, again, for us as men, if we never received it. It's very difficult for us to step into that space and to really mentor our boys in that area. But the simple question is, well, if you're not going to do it, the only promise I can make to you, as one I've made to parents around the world, that if you won't do it, then I can promise you that someone or something else will. So the impact, this is from the Lancet, just on gaming, on the impact of violent imagery. So I don't want to do a communist under the bed sequence here, that's the end of the world and that you need to move to an Amish community as quickly as possible. Karen and I have picked one, no. But I just want you to be aware that these profound cultural forces are shaping how boys are being socialised. Again, I'm not providing a value judgment on this next slide, but it's quite an interesting, again, sociological snapshot, which is it's the percentage of unmarried age males at 25 to 29. And if you've got any kind of stats or postgrad background, that is a seismic cultural shift. It's not small, it's massive. So for most of human history, men tended to partner early and enter into the stream of the masculine project relatively early in life. They're now avoiding it, which has all sorts of knock-on effects in a culture. So I'm not saying your son has to get married at 19. I'm just saying, what do we think happens culturally when men are avoiding the forms of commitments that could also make them help them become great men as well? So some of you will go, well, they're marrying later. Yes, but that also has interesting cultural knock-on effects. Last couple of key points. This is Professor Jean Twenge, who is the world's foremost expert on narcissism. Narcissism is growing at an incredible rate. Her data argues that it's tripled in a generation, narcissism indicator scores. So Anne Mann wrote a book recently that I read that just says that the problem of narcissism is growing worse because it's culturally reinforced. So summary for you, worst case scenario, disengaged absent fathering, boys highly socialised into internet-based pornography and violent gaming. Every boy know, your son, I don't know. Boys are being encouraged to link their freedom to the size of their options, the number of options they can keep open for as long as possible. Whereas what we know as men in the room, again, is that, in fact, some of our freedom has come from committing to options and staying committed to them. Okay, moving on. My other insight into working with boys was just what I call a fundamental problem captured nicely in this graphic, which is just when I spoke at one of the GPS schools in Sydney, I did an 8-week program for the year 10 boys where I would fly up once a week and do a program with them. At the end of the first week, I asked them to write anonymous questions about anything we discussed so far, sex, pornography, study, school, sport, anything, nothing off limits, as long as it wasn't illegal. And I had this big stack of questions. I'm going back to the airport in the car, and I honestly remember this for the rest of my life. It's I'm sitting in a taxi, and one question really impacted me. Was a boy had written very simply, "How do you talk to girls?" And what struck me about it wasn't how poignant the question was. It was simply, "Why is he asking me?" Incredibly expensive school in a first world democracy, with access to all sorts of counselling and resources. Why is he asking a complete stranger a deeply beautiful personal question about adolescence? The answer would seem to be that there was nobody else he could ask. again, is it every boy? No, but many boys, I would say perhaps most in my humble experience talking and working with hundreds of thousands of them now, is that as they transition through these key moments of life, many of them are profoundly alone. And when I said that to them today at key points, you get a deathly silence in the room. They have questions about their bodies, about romance, intimacy, life, failure, success. They just queued up today. They literally queued up and formed queues to come and talk to me one-on-one. Because I'm so spectacularly brilliant? No. I mean, I'm reasonably good and insightful at asking good questions and listening to people. But a couple of times today I was like, oh, have you talked to Dad about this? Or have you talked to Mum? And they're like, oh, not quite. So don't leave them alone. And balance this. Don't crash their space either with endless, you okay? You okay? No, you really okay? You okay today? I just want to check this morning. You still okay? I checked with you last night. Are you okay last night? Are you okay this morning? But again, just I hope I'm not losing any mothers in the room by really challenging the fathers. But my humble experience, again, has not been that mothers are our issue. I don't hear boys often saying, oh, I'm having big issues with Mum. If only Mum was more, no. But if men will really step into this space, I just really want to encourage you to do that. Don't leave them alone. Interestingly, another little side interest of mine is etymology. I love etymology, the study of where words come from. If you find often the root of a word, it tells you an enormous amount of interesting information. When I was doing men's seminars, I eventually found out that the word husband comes into Old English from the Nordic husbonda, which means he or the one who dwells in the home. That our task as men and as fathers is to be present in the home. Here's me on the other side of the country. But 95% of the time I'm home. And I did a podcast on the weekend. I do a podcast every Monday. And I did part of the podcast on a simple principle, which is wherever you are, be all there. Wherever you are, be all there. If you come and talk to me tonight one-on-one, you'll notice that I will seem quite intense because I really like listening to people. And when you're talking to me, I have another mantra. Who's the most important person in the world? The person right in front of you. If you're at home, really be at home. Be present, be engaged, because again, for men, the husbander is the one who dwells in the home. Richard Rohr, the American writer, talks about the absence of fathers here. Beautiful image here of Christian Barnard, who did the world's first ever live heart transplant, the greatest heart surgeons or cardiac surgeons in history. In his biography, there's a beautiful moment where he says these words. He says, when we were sick as children, our father would doctor us. I had ingrown toenails that hurt so much I would cry. My father would make a poultice out of sunlight, soap and sugar that would draw the poison out. When we had colds, he would rub Vicks into our chests and sit with us until we'd fall asleep. On Sundays after lunch, my father and I would take walks to the dam above the village. And there we would sit and look out upon the town, and I would speak of my problems to my father, and my father would speak of his to me. And I say, is it interesting that he goes on to become a specialist in the heart. So there is this great hunger in our culture and in our homes. And again, if you're parenting as a single mother, so much can still be done here. When I first started this work, I used to talk to mothers afterwards and I'd say, oh, look, you know, can you find, you know, an uncle or somebody and just be up front with them? And I got to the point where I said, find any male without a criminal record and just ask specifically for help and assistance. And I'm not, it sounds a little flippant, but really, I also say to men that if you notice, and this is not remotely patronizing, but if you notice a boy who doesn't have a father engaged in his life, then it is not impossible for you to give out of your excess. To be perhaps, for some of you, a father to the fatherless. So the question of identity is a big one. So I said to the boys today, did you notice that the girls in MLC don't tend to try and prove womanhood to each other? And I've never been a woman, but I can't imagine that you, I don't know, but I'm really on thin ice here, but I'm going, women don't tend to try and prove womanhood to each other as such, whereas boys, adolescent boys, will constantly go into proving behaviours, demonstrating masculine capacities and strengths and showing to their peer network that they're normal, they're okay. So they carry this core question of identity. What they're doing culturally, in the absence of us giving them a strong sense of their goodness as men and their potential as men, is they're going for what we call the big three, which is to drink as much as possible, to lose their virginity as quickly as possible, which develops into an attitude of sexual conquest of women, and physical intimidation and violence. So in the absence of a culture that will socialise them in better ways and give them more ways to become good men, booze, sexual conquest and physical violence. Some statistical background for it, 60% of the 300,000 criminal cases, 60% alcohol related, 60%. So do that thought experiment, take alcohol out of the equation and your crime rate drops by 60%. So this country has a particular romance with alcohol and masculinity. I'm not saying don't drink, I'm saying we have a cultural romance with it, especially as men, that is bordering on the problematic. What do we do about the identity question? Is what I did with the boys today is just to give you a simple construct to work with. My opinion after all these years is just this. In manhood is a wonderful strength. And what men have to do in their lives is simply resolve what they are going to do with their strength, what they will devote their strength to, how they will use their energy and their capacity as men. So boys and men will either channel their energy into something beyond themselves, or they will channel it internally into destructive behaviours. I don't see a third. I haven't come across a third. One way I can prove it to you is to ask yourself, who is the finest man you have ever known? All of you think right now, who's the finest man you've ever known? What you will probably find is that his energy, his masculine self, was in all the interactions of his life, with his failings as well, was channeled into something beyond himself, usually to the love and service of others in some way. So what I think it means to be a fine man and how we raise boys to be a fine man is not rocket science. I mean, St. Ignatius talked about men for others. You know, that's and I had that conversation with the boys today. So I had 150, 200 at a time, adolescent males, speaking to them in this language, and they get really quiet because it connects with them at some level. So how do you actually become a man? What the sociologists and anthropologists kept coming up with, in at least my postgrad background, was that manhood is conferred or bestowed. When do you become a man? Anthropologically, you become one when your father or the community of men tell you you are. And the desire and hunger for the affirmation of the father is enormously powerful. Hear that one more time. The hunger for the affirmation and the approval of the father is enormously powerful. And I'll show you just exactly how it plays out. The world's first billion-dollar athlete. And if you read the biography by his coach, Lee Haney, there's this fascinating scene where Tiger Woods in his mansion at Jupiter Island would often play PlayStation 8 to 12 hours at a time. Navy had headsets on playing Navy SOCOM SEALs. And what you probably don't know about Tiger Woods is at one point in his career he had an almost career-ending knee injury, chronic knee injury. And I used to joke, you know, how he got the injury? And people laughed. I go, no, it wasn't his wife chasing him down the driveway with a golf club. It was, he was actually, not many people know this, is in the biography that he would, whenever he wasn't playing golf on free weekends, he would be training with the US Navy SEALs. He had a lot of contacts and he would constantly be going out doing all this training with them. Interestingly, what his father did for a career was he was a colonel in the US Special Forces. And you find in the biography this profound, constant need for the affirmation and approval of his father. And you could see how the trajectory of an entire life was powerfully driven by this deep, deep need. The other example I came across was the greatest basketballer in history, Michael Jordan. I just read the 700-page biography by Isaacson on Jordan. Really interesting. The book starts with some really moving stuff. Michael Jordan idolized his father. His father treated him terribly. His father really loved his older brother a hell of a lot more. And there's scenes at the start of the book where Michael Jordan's father would be out tinkering with cars with the older brother. And Michael would come out wanting to get involved, and his father would always say, "You get back inside with the women." It was shocking to hear. It was just endless. It was like, "You get inside with the women." And the book finishes with Jordan, after all this phenomenal career, sitting on his own in the stadium of the team that he's just bought. He bought the Hornets for $400 million. They're now valued at $1 billion. And the book finishes with him sitting as the lights turn out, whispering, "Is it okay now, Dad? Do I have to go inside anymore?" An entire life driven by this absence of something. And we can say, well, look what he achieved. I know, but at what cost? If mothers and fathers will step into that space and confer a strong sense of identity on the heart of a young man, tell them who they are. Sounds a bit blunt, doesn't it? How can you do that? They're individuals. I think you have a very strong power as parents to tell them who they are, to give them a vision of who they could be. Anthropologically, how is it actually done? How do you do this conferring process? I want to show you this. It's quite powerful. Four steps to transitioning boys into men. Didn't come up with this myself. This is drawn on anthropological studies from South America right through the Pacific Islands into Africa. Four stages. So why I'm pitching this to you is because if we don't do this work, if you leave your son's transition into manhood up to chance, well, we hope it'll work out. Four steps. Number one, what traditional cultures did first was to separate boys at a key moment from the culture around them. So there's a need to eventually take boys away somewhere. Richard Rohr tells a story in his book of this African tribe, true story, where the boy would be born. He would know who his father was, but just the way the culture was set up, he would live with his mother till he was about 12. He would know his father. There would be a relationship of sorts, but not incredibly close. The boy would wake up one morning to an unusual sound. He would hear this chanting. He'd never heard it before, and he would go to the doorway of this hut. And standing about 50 metres away would be his father and all the men of the village. And they're all chanting exactly the same thing at the top of their voices. They're yelling out over and over again, "Come out, son of my people. Come out, son of my people." The community of men calling the man from the boy. It's time now. It's time to step into the current of manhood. It's time. And the mother's awesome. She's in on this, right? Her job is to stand there, and she sings back, "He's not here. The one you're looking for is not here." Her job is to keep him there. And eventually she stands aside, and it's quite a beautiful image of him flying out into the community of men. Step one, separation from the community. If you want your boy to eventually transition, you'll need to make time for this to happen. And I'll give you some ideas how to do that in just a second. Step two, liminal space. All traditional cultures would eventually put boys in a place where none of their BS worked. So boys they run what we call patterns. With their peer networks, they'll run patterns. Patterns of physical aggression, drinking, language patterns about women or body parts. Boys will run patterns. What they did in traditional cultures was the men would take them out, sit them on a rock somewhere and leave them for 3 days. You can't do that, it's illegal. Because teachers keep asking if they can. I say, no, you can't do that. But the whole thing was to communicate to them, you are separate to us. You are not one of us yet. I often joke about, you know, think about the US Marines when they have their first induction, when the guys get off the bus. You can see this on YouTube. It doesn't look like this. The guys don't get off the bus, come into a room like this, and the drill sergeant doesn't stand there and say, hi, everybody, welcome to the Marines. I'll be your drill sergeant today. Thanks for coming. It's great to have you with us. We've got a few options today. We thought we'd start with some haircuts. We have several for you to choose from. No, it doesn't work. It's just lots of shouting and yelling, and all of it is disruptive. And these days, some of us would call it bastardization, but it's basically a process of, oh, my gosh, where do I fit? What's happening here? I don't know where I am. It's a kind of breaking down process of, I have a goal to be this eventually, but right now everything is telling me I'm not that yet. And boys need to sense that they're not part of that community yet. Step three is boys need to be tested. Some of you here as men, can you remember times in life where you've been really tested and that moment of actually meeting that challenge? It's a wonderful experience for all of us as humans, but as you know, for us as men, when we get tested and we come through, it's quite a profound experience. So traditional cultures would do all sorts of things. In the Sepik River province, they cut them over 1,000 times. These little cuts, and they scarred for life. Some of them die. Don't do that. But there was this point of testing. And finally, boys would be returned to the community with a new name. So they would be brought back to the community, but in the African community, they would change the name of the boy. The father would give the son a new name, and everybody in the village would relate to him differently. So all of this is a fancy way of saying that the transition into manhood must be deliberate, scheduled. Basically, no one's doing it. I can't make you do it, but I can tell you that I've read vast amounts about it, and I will be doing it. So that when Aiden was born, I got to choose Aiden's name, not because we set it up that way, but I just had a really strong desire to name him after Aidan, who at the age of 22, St. Aidan of Lindisfarne, walked off the west coast of Scotland and single-handedly kind of converted large parts of Europe. St. Aidan is buried on the left-hand side of the altar in the church at Iona on the west coast of Scotland. So when my Aidan is somewhere between 12 to 14, 15, I'll take him there. And I'll plan a very extensive process of validating him and doing this process with him. And eventually I want him to stand there with me and say, before you were born, I named you on the charism and on the character of this person who is buried here 1,100 years before you were born. And give him a sense of that identity and connection. Because that's how seriously I take it. I'm assuming the camera's probably not working now. I'll just edit it out. But as I shared with the boys today, I was in the Salvation Army refuge at the age of 15. My father grew up with chronic depression, so I lived through all sorts of dysfunction and trauma and abuse growing up, and I just don't have to repeat it because I want to be very deliberate about how I love and do the best I can with the kids. So if we're not prepared to do this, boys are not just going to sit passively by and do nothing. What boys tend to do is they're going to try and take it by force. So all the toxic stuff we're seeing in our culture, violence against women, alcohol, vehicle accidents, physical violence and intimidation, is all just manhood channeled in toxic ways. And there's so much we can do to change that. Would you... That's the end of the heavy stuff. When you come back, we're going to look at some really simple, practical stuff about what we can do to change. That's a snapshot of what's happening for the boys. Please, we got coffee available, don't we, Mark? Is that what we do? All right, let's have a really quick break, grab some water, race to the bathroom. We'll start again in about 5 or so minutes, and I'll get you home by midnight, I promise. Well, there you go. That's the end of part one. I'm Jonathan Dore. Great to be back with you. I hope you've really got something out of there. There's a lot of stuff in there. It's deep stuff, but hopefully you've got more of an insight into what's happening for young people and some of those core tasks for us as parents. So now make sure you access part two, where we're going to talk more about how we can really address key issues for ourselves as parents so we can be more effective. So grab that second one, and I'll be speaking to you again very soon.